C1B 1 and 2.
Number 10A.
We come now to the last subject of this part 1, love. And whenever one comes to the tone of love in a sequence that runs from mind up to love, one always notices that naturally love has somehow a different connotation than the other synonymous term, because you know how in the 7 days of creation you have up to the sixth day you have a creative ability and a creative function going on, and then in the seventh day you have no more a function, no more a creative ability, everything is complete. But it needs somehow that last seventh day to give us the rest, where all that great question of dissolving evil is resolved. And so you may find here that the tonality of the subtones are perhaps a little bit different, in so far as in the seventh subject here, all the subtones seem to go out right from the synonymous term and just state right out from there that the counterfeit, so to say, is dissolved. Let's say what it means here. The tone of love, you know, is there where we find that we have found our perfect unity with God, where we don't have any more to strive to get nearer and nearer and approach God, but where we see that principle and idea is one, and that that idea is so, that that relationship is so close that we perceive that love can never be without its manifestation or object. This idea comes out here through the subtones very, very clearly. Always that sense that the idea is always in principle, that the idea is always embedded in love, has never left really the synonymous term, so that the opposite is just at the state of being dissolved. So the idea of man's oneness with God naturally dissolves the belief that man is separate from God, that man could ever have fallen away from God, that man would ever have to go back to God, and it just wants to bring out that man is one with God. From the point of view of mind, we again get the statement of the contraposition, and here, as mind, I summarize it like this: man is a mental manifestation of divine mind. The contraposition, he comes from no power of propagation in matter. You see the difference in tonality perhaps here. Say, we would have perhaps been used that in order to bring out the contraposition, that Mrs. Eddy perhaps would have said here that really that the man that is created by human parents is not the real man, something like that. But now it's a bit different, you can see, because of the closeness of principle and idea. And so it just says that he cannot come from any other power of propagation, and therefore not from the propagation of matter. The side note is mental propagation. And so the whole tone is on mind, you know, mind that creates, that produces, that makes, that propagates. It's all that creative sense. And so Mrs. Eddy considers here the oneness, the unity of mind as the creator, as the propagator, and says that man is therefore, on man's true consciousness, is therefore the mental likeness of spirit. He is the reflection of the creative power of principle. It is a mental manifestation. It is a reflection of the multitudinous forms of mind. Can you hear always mind? And concludes, there is no power of propagation in matter. You see, she doesn't say that mortal man is propagated by the human mind or by human parents. So it just says there is no possibility for any propagating power anywhere else but in the divine mind. So we begin to fill our thought and see all what she says here is always that man comes from God. No matter if it's mind or principle or spirit that is being used here, the creator is mind. He propagates man. He creates man. Man is a mental manifestation. You know, mind manifests itself. He's created by the creative power of God. And so he is a form or creation of mind, and the whole tone is on that tone. Which would tell us, really, that if we start out with that whole subject, that we would begin to see that really in love we find the parent mind, because the parent mind says, I have a child. The parents can never be parents without having children. So it's more than just the creator that is being brought out, but really that parent mind that says, in order to be parent, I have to have children. I have to have a manifestation. There is no question about that God is a creator and the creation is not manifested, and we don't see the manifestation of God, and where is the manifestation of God? When will we see the manifestation of God? There is just not that question left anymore. Just keep that in your spiritual ear, you know, that love, love, love is that which says God is never without its manifestation, is never without its object, is never with it, never without its representative. That's love. And you see, it has nothing to do with a better human sense of love, of a betterment of a loving attitude or of Christian love. This is science here. She shows here the scientific sense of love, which shows that in being there is such a terrific fact which says, you know, in being there is not just a creator. In being there is that fact that the creator is always expressed and manifested as is creation. And that relationship of the synonymous term being manifested as the idea, as one, that's love. It's a very deep, deep idea that has to be thought about and pondered very deeply, because it's only that that takes away any sense that we ever could be separated from God, that anything could ever happen which is separated from God, so that we have no fear, no sense of being excluded or being pushed aside or anything like that. We always feel where God is, the expression of God is also in its fullness. Here mind is not only God's mind. Here mind is the mind of love, which says mind is expressed as a creation, is manifested as its creation. There is no more a question about that. We come to spirit and we see the wonderful unfoldment to the creative order, that once we have had mind as the creator, that we get really spirit as that which conceives, brings forth, gives birth. That's the next step after the creative ability, that the child has to be born and is being born, and that spirit gives birth. Here I have epitomized it like this. Man is conceived, born, and evolved from spirit, not matter. Here you have the contraposition. And any other statement is unreal, elusive. Yeah? Again, we have a greater sense of showing reality and unreality, factuality and not factuality, therefore elusiveness. That here she shows that, I run quickly through the text just to show what she is saying, and that she is constantly talking about the birth of spirit. She speaks about all the minutiae of all individualities, that they reflect spirit, reflect the one divine individuality, that they are comprehended in spirit. They are in the womb of spirit. Love is the womb. Here they are. Every idea is already comprehended, taken in, and bosomed by spirit. They are formed, she says, by spirit, conceived by spirit, and born by spirit. You hear, they are all ideas of spirit. And we can just see that if we are familiar with the tonality of the synonymous term, we just can't mistake that she is speaking here constantly about the motherhood of spirit, showing that love is never without its objectification. Therefore, in spirit, spirit is never without the child that is born. It's never barren. Spirit is never barren. It's always at the point where it brings forth and evolves. And so she says, therefore, man is born by spirit, and so man is not both material and spiritual. I'll get that tone. And this is only, and this is a statement, sorry, I must put it right. If we say that man is both material and spiritual, she says, this is only a statement, it is not a reality. Stating something doesn't make it real or true. It's only a statement which contradicts eternal truth. Can you hear now the other tone coming in? Eternal truth, spirit, life truth comes now in between and says this contradicts eternal truth, because eternal truth is that man is only spiritual. And so she underlies it and says the truth about is that man is only spiritual, and this is the eternal fact. Nothing can make these contraries true. Again, you have a sense of truth coming in. These contraries, you see, cannot be true, and science will eventually destroy this illusion. So you can see I have now read to you not only those parts which have to do solely with the tone of love and spirit, but also with the counterfeit sense, which says man is apparently a mingling of spirit and matter, and one says so, it is a statement, but it is not a fact, and you come in with the subject of spirit, life and truth, which says, therefore, that is a lie, it's not true, and therefore it's not something that is life, because everything is spiritual. I just wanted to show you again with an example. Naturally, they are all over the place. I didn't bring them out because it can bewilder the listener. But just so that when you are at home and go through the text, with the help of these epitomes, that you may suddenly find, yes, but there are sentences, perhaps half of a paragraph, that speaks about something else. And that something else may be, in one case, just that she always has to support her sayings to say, you know what I say here is spiritually true, and these are the eternal facts. Always to support also that life, substance and intelligence is spiritual, not material. So will you perhaps remember that when you go through the text, that I am aware of these other instruments that are playing in that orchestra, but if we keep them apart, we know that the running theme, that which is really uninterruptedly going through the text, is that theme of mind, spirit, soul, principle, life, truth, and love in their subtones. That's a consistent theme. We come to soul, a wonderful text here, because we can see that soul, seen from the motherhood of love, would really bring out very definitely that sense of love, because we have said, what is love? We said, love is that which is never without its manifestation, is that which is never without its representative, is that which is never without its object. It's so one with its expression that it is identical in nature with its expression. And that naturally is the motherhood of soul, bringing out here now in the text that identical, or that identity of expression. I have summarized it like this: man is God's own expression. It's not only just an expression, but it's God's own expression. It still belongs to God. It is not so that, like in the human picture, you have a mother and a father and they have a child, and suddenly the child is no more belonging to the parent. It does no more belong to them. Whereas in the spiritual realm, the expression always belongs to the Creator. Always. It's therefore God's own expression. God possesses that expression. Because God possesses that expression, it will also look after that expression when it comes to life, truth, and love. It will never let it go. And here in soul, this is brought out, and therefore can never lose his high estate. Soul knows no loss. You know that. Because soul is identity. Identity is only identity when it never loses anything. How does she develop the subject? She always begins very simply and works the subject up and up and up until she comes to a climax. She goes out and shows that what seems to be a mortal, material man, that is not the likeness of God. That is not God's own likeness. That it is just the belief of all the minglings that goes on between opposites. Opposites like pain and pleasure, life and death, holiness and unholiness. She could have gone on giving 10 examples, 100 examples. He's not a mingling of opposites. What is he then? And so you have as a marginal heading, man's entity spiritual. The moment I hear man's entity, I really hear man's identity, what he is as himself, what he is per se, that's his entity. The moment I hear that, I know she's speaking about soul, and she says, he, man, is, now you get again, the image and likeness, see, the whole identity of God. And now she brings in love and says, you see, if he would not be the image and likeness of God, then God would not be. Else God would be without a witness. Else mind would be unexpressed. Else God would be a non-entity. Can you hear those three examples? In three ways she brings out the love sense. That if there would not be a representative called spiritual man as the image and likeness of God, then there would be no God. Then there would be no mind expressed. Then there would be no God. God would therefore be a non-entity. Nothing. Can you think about that? That if man in its image and likeness would not be, there would not be a God. Yeah? The moment we accept that there is a God, we must accept that there is a man in its full image and likeness. Or else we make a reasoning that is illogical, that breaks the train of reasoning. But the human mind tries to separate that and say, oh yes, there is a God. But he's not always expressed, because he dreams and slumbers sometimes, and you have quite a time to wake him up and say, hello, get on your job, do something. That's our attitude. If he would be quite aware of the fact that God can only exist because man in his image and likeness exists, then we would be very calm and at peace. So she goes on and says, therefore, man is the idea of God. An idea cannot be lost. You see again, that unity of love and love's idea cannot be severed, cannot be lost. The idea cannot be separated from principle. Isn't it amazing how through many, many renderings within a short text, she brings out just one thing, that because man exists, God must exist. So she says, man inseparable from love, as a marginal heading. And here we have those great statements about love at the point of soul, where she says, divine love cannot be deprived of its manifestation. Nothing can alienate him from the sweet sense and presence of life and truth. Nothing can alienate him. Nothing can separate him. Just think that divine love cannot be deprived of its manifestation. Even if we would only start with belief, without understanding, even if we would start just with faith, without understanding, would stick to that fact, which is a fact, that love can never be deprived of its manifestation, we would always see that love actually has, in every situation, at every time, in every position, always its perfect manifestation. If he hasn't, there is no God. There is no God. We better then pack up and go fishing and have a jolly good time for a while. We have to take that consequence, see and say, if we accept the nature of love, then we must accept that God is always fully expressed. And we can't say, no, here and there, God is not fully expressed. Now are we going to make a demonstration that he is going to be fully expressed? Can you see how it would be wonderful if we would sit back and just ponder them until it would become our own nature and would be being our every fiber of our life, so that we would never have a sense that something is not at the point of perfection. Therefore then she shows from the point of view of soul, joy can therefore not be turned into sorrow. You know, we had that before when we had in the chapter on creation, you remember, when we had love as soul, we had that too. We saw that the pains of sense are salutary, that they rejoice the heart, that the pains of sense cannot really rob us from the joy. Here, joy cannot be turned into sorrow. This is now the positive standpoint that she gives. Therefore, life can never result in death. Because if love maintains her identity as soul, then love can never turn into its opposite. So, mind cannot be turned into mortal mind, spirit cannot be turned into matter, principle cannot be turned into personality, life cannot be turned into death, and truth cannot be turned into a lie, and love cannot be turned into hate.